This is the presidential series from TP Newsroom, a four-part look at how modern presidents shaped policy, power, and the country we're living in today. Each entry stands alone, but together they show the long arc of decisions that built the America we inherited. Part 3, George W. Bush. He didn't walk in with the swagger of his father. George W. Bush wasn't crowned by pedigree. Though he carried the name, he earned his rise the old-fashioned way, by learning how to sell the room. And in 2000, that's exactly what America bought. A steady hand, a born-again everyman, someone who talked just like the people who still believed in church on Sunday and football on Friday. He wasn't the smartest man in the room, but he didn't need to be. What mattered was that he made people feel like they were the smartest, like government had gotten too bloated, too elite, and he was just the guy to bring it back down to earth. His campaign didn't promise revolution. It promised restoration. Bush ran on compassion, conservatism, and the idea that decency had a place in politics again. After the Clinton years, scandal-stained and saturated in cultural division, voters leaned into the simplicity of his message. No new taxes, strong schools, local control, morality, modesty. It wasn't exciting, it was familiar. And that familiarity won him the White House, barely. When the dust settled from the Florida recount, Bush took office not with a mandate, but with a margin. Yet from the moment he stepped into the Oval Office, he governed like he had both. The early months of his presidency moved quietly. Tax cuts rolled through. Environmental regulations were trimmed. Faith-based initiatives got top billing. There was a rhythm to it. Calculated, restrained, unambitious. Then came September 11th. In less than 2 hours, the nation was transformed. Buildings fell, markets froze, fear became policy, and Bush, the affable placeholder president, became the wartime leader. That morning didn't just define his presidency, it redefined the presidency itself. Everything that came after 9/11 carried the imprint of that day. The speeches, the laws, the budgets, the doctrines. America wasn't just responding to a terrorist attack, it was reorienting its entire political identity. Bush didn't hesitate. He stood on the rubble with a bullhorn, declared war on terror, and vowed revenge with a clarity that comforted a shell-shocked country. But what started as retaliation turned into something else, something permanent. The Patriot Act was rushed through Congress with near unanimous support, giving the federal government sweeping surveillance powers with minimal oversight. Phone records, emails, library checkouts, all fair game. It was framed as temporary, a necessary evil to protect American lives, but it never really went away. The architecture of the surveillance state wasn't just built under Bush, it was normalized. The Department of Homeland Security was created, an entirely new cabinet-level agency that consolidated 22 federal departments and agencies under one roof. Airports became security zones. Local police departments were infused with federal dollars to adopt military-grade equipment. The very definition of freedom was rebranded, no longer about privacy or liberty, but about safety, strength, and submission to national security. The invasion of Afghanistan felt justified. The invasion of Iraq didn't, but Bush didn't flinch. Backed by cherry-picked intelligence, emotionally charged rhetoric, and a media establishment too afraid to ask the hard questions, he led the US into a war based on weapons that didn't exist. Shock and awe played like a movie trailer. The mission was declared accomplished on the deck of an aircraft carrier. And yet, the war dragged on for years. For lives, for trillions of dollars that disappeared into defense contractor pockets and foreign aid packages with no accountability. Saddam was captured, Iraq was destabilized, and the very act that was supposed to protect American soil ended up radicalizing the region and fracturing US credibility abroad. Domestically, the economy took a backseat to the war effort, but the seeds of economic collapse were already being watered. Bush pushed through more tax cuts, tilted toward the wealthy, arguing that economic growth required letting markets run free. Deregulation wasn't just a philosophy, it was policy. The SEC loosened its grip. Oversight became suggestion. Meanwhile, predatory lending surged, subprime mortgages ballooned, and Wall Street bet big on the very collapse it was engineering. It wouldn't fully crash until the tail end of Bush's second term, but the groundwork was already there, layered, silent, waiting. Education reform came dressed as a solution, no child left behind. The law promised accountability, but delivered rigidity. Test scores became currency. Funding was tied to performance, which led to more teaching for the test and less real learning. Schools in disadvantaged areas suffered the most, punished for conditions they couldn't control. The rhetoric was noble, the outcome was uneven, and as with many Bush policies, the intention got lost beneath the implementation. But for all the policy, all the press conferences, all the photo ops with troops and flags and school children, what defined George W. Bush wasn't just what he did, it was what he enabled. He ushered in an era of unchecked executive power. He shifted the Overton window on surveillance, secrecy, and war. He presided over the death of the budget surplus and the birth of deficit culture as default. He deepened partisan divides, not through volume, but through velocity. Because everything moved faster under Bush, not because he was an innovator, but because 9/11 gave him cover. He didn't need to be a visionary, he just needed to be unwavering. And in that steadiness, policies were passed that reshaped the country, quietly, thoroughly, and often irreversibly. His presidency became a blueprint, not for leadership, but for how to use fear to govern, how to spin tragedy into political capital, how to make permanent changes feel like temporary measures until it's too late to reverse them. He left office with low approval ratings and a country teetering on economic collapse, but his legacy lived on, in airports, in foreign policy, in government databases, in the normalization of preemptive war and privatized military conflict. What Bush broke wasn't always visible, but it was fundamental, because by the time he left, trust was fractured. The surplus was gone. The war wasn't over. And the idea that government could lie to its people for their own good, that had become part of the American story. Quiet, assumed, unchallenged. You can't talk about George W. Bush without talking about the myth of responsibility, the idea that Republicans are the party of fiscal conservatism, budget balance, and restraint. It's an image that sells well in campaign ads, but Bush's record tells a different story. He inherited a surplus, a real one. In 2000, the Congressional Budget Office projected trillions in extra funds over the next decade, so much that policy wonks started talking about what the government would do once the national debt was paid off. That's how good things looked. But that surplus didn't last, and it didn't disappear by accident. Bush's first major legislative action was a tax cut, not a mild adjustment, but a sweeping, top-heavy rollback of income taxes, capital gains, estate taxes, and corporate burdens. The Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001 was sold as a way to return money to the people. But the people who got the biggest returns weren't struggling families. They were the already wealthy. The top 1% saw windfalls. Middle-class families got a few hundred bucks. And the budget surplus? It began bleeding out immediately. Then came the wars, Afghanistan, Iraq, global counterterrorism campaigns. Billions upon billions poured into military contractors, weapon systems, reconstruction projects that never got finished, and none of it was paid for. There was no wartime tax, no sacrifice spread across the population. Instead, Bush did the opposite. He doubled down on tax cuts in 2003 with the Jobs and Growth Tax Relief Reconciliation Act. While soldiers fought overseas, the richest Americans got more relief. The government took in less, spent more, and borrowed the difference. The math didn't lie. The deficit exploded. But it wasn't just about spending. It was about philosophy. Bush-era economics wasn't just trickle-down. It was trust-fall capitalism. Trust that markets knew best, that Wall Street would self-regulate, that the private sector could do what government couldn't. That's how you get Medicare Part D, a massive new prescription drug benefit signed into law in 2003, which explicitly barred the government from negotiating lower drug prices. It was a windfall for pharmaceutical companies, a long-term cost for taxpayers, and again, it wasn't paid for. This was the same logic behind the push to privatize Social Security. Bush didn't succeed, but he tried. He proposed letting younger workers divert a portion of their Social Security taxes into private investment accounts. Wall Street cheered. Older Americans panicked. The proposal tanked in Congress, but the intent was clear: shift responsibility away from collective programs and toward individual markets. If you win, great. If you lose, it's on you. Housing was the quiet beast growing in the background. In the name of ownership and the American dream, the Bush administration leaned into mortgage expansion. The Federal Reserve kept interest rates low. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac relaxed standards. Banks started slicing and selling mortgage-backed securities like candy, and nobody wanted to say no because home ownership numbers were rising. GDP looked good. Wall Street was booming. But beneath the surface, risk was metastasizing. This is the part of the story that gets washed out by 9/11 and war headlines. The deregulation of the financial sector didn't begin with Bush. It dates back to the Clinton-era repeal of Glass-Steagall. But Bush poured gasoline on it. His administration was openly hostile to financial oversight. The SEC was underfunded and understaffed. Warnings about risky lending practices were ignored. And when whistleblowers raised alarms, they were sidelined. Subprime loans weren't seen as a danger. They were seen as innovation, credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations, bundled risk packaged as AAA safety. Bush didn't invent any of it, but he presided over it, and he let the fantasy of limitless growth drown out every warning bell. By the time the housing bubble burst in 2007, it was too late. The financial system was already infected, investment banks collapsed, retirement accounts evaporated, and millions of Americans lost homes they never should have qualified for in the first place. Bush's Treasury Department scrambled. So did the Fed. Bailouts began. Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail. AIG was rescued. TARP was passed. $700 billion to stabilize the system. But the damage was done. Unemployment surged. Foreclosures skyrocketed. Consumer confidence tanked. The average American watched their savings disappear while the executives who helped create the crisis walked away with bonuses. That's the real legacy of Bush-era economics. Not just the deficit, but the normalization of privatized gain and socialized loss. When things were good, the profits went to shareholders. When things collapsed, the losses were absorbed by the public. It wasn't capitalism in the textbook sense. It was selective protection. Risk was rewarded. Failure was rescued. Accountability was theoretical. And through it all, Bush kept selling the message: tax cuts work, markets heal, and government should get out of the way. It was a brand, a belief, but it wasn't sustainable. By the end of his presidency, the national debt had doubled. The surplus had become a memory, and the myth of Republican fiscal responsibility, already cracked, was shattered. The planes hit at 8:46 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. What followed wasn't just a national tragedy. It was a rupture in how America saw itself. The Bush presidency, up until that moment, had been defined by tax cuts and modest approval ratings. But after September 11th, 2001, everything changed. The country unified in fear, rage, and trauma. And Bush, overnight, became a wartime president. He didn't shy away from it. He leaned in. "You're either with us or you're with the terrorists," he declared, just 9 days after the attack. That line wasn't just rhetorical. It became policy, and it reshaped the very foundation of American governance. The creation of the Department of Homeland Security was one of the largest bureaucratic overhauls in U.S. history. Over 20 federal agencies were folded into a single megastructure, all under the banner of national security. It sounded efficient, but in practice, it blurred lines. Immigration, disaster response, domestic intelligence, and border enforcement were now part of the same apparatus. It centralized authority, and that centralization came with a new ethos: preemption over prevention, suspicion over nuance, and force over diplomacy. The Patriot Act passed just 6 weeks after 9/11. It wasn't subtle. It expanded surveillance powers, reduced judicial oversight, and gave federal agents sweeping authority to wiretap, detain, and investigate without standard protocols. Few lawmakers read the full bill before signing it. The mood was urgency. The atmosphere was panic. And under that panic, the Constitution was rewritten in practice, if not on paper. Libraries had to report suspicious reading habits. Banks flagged financial transfers. Muslim communities were monitored en masse. The line between freedom and security got redrawn, and the new line tilted heavily toward control. The Bush administration didn't just redefine domestic policy, it rewired foreign policy too. Afghanistan was first. The Taliban was toppled quickly, but no clear exit strategy followed. Then, Iraq, sold to the public on shaky claims of weapons of mass destruction. There were no WMDs, but the war happened anyway. Preemptive strike became an acceptable doctrine, regime change became strategy, and spreading democracy became the fig leaf over a war of choice. The cost wasn't just trillions of dollars, it was lives. Over 4,000 US troops killed in Iraq alone, tens of thousands wounded, and hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians dead. But it wasn't just war casualties, it was torture, black sites, extraordinary rendition, waterboarding, Guantanamo Bay, legal justifications for actions once considered unthinkable. The Bush administration didn't deny it, they redefined it. Torture wasn't torture, it was enhanced interrogation. Geneva Conventions weren't ignored, they were reinterpreted. The Office of Legal Counsel, meant to provide impartial advice, became a rubber stamp for executive power. This wasn't an accident, it was design. Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld were architects of the new normal. They believed the presidency had been weakened after Watergate, and 9/11 was the excuse to reverse that trend. The unitary executive theory became doctrine. The president didn't just lead the country, he embodied it. Checks and balances became speed bumps, the legal framework bent to fit the war. And while the war on terror raged abroad, its effects seeped into everyday American life. Airports became military zones. Protesters were corralled into free speech zones. Muslims, Sikhs, and South Asians faced violence, harassment, and profiling. Entire communities lived under suspicion, not for what they'd done, but for who they were. Citizenship no longer guaranteed full protection. It became a conditional pass, subject to revocation if you looked or worshiped the wrong way. The surveillance state wasn't temporary. It metastasized. The NSA began bulk data collection, phone calls, emails, internet activity, most of it without warrants. The Fourth Amendment became a suggestion. Whistleblowers like Thomas Drake and later Edward Snowden tried to raise alarms, but the system had already entrenched itself. Privacy was rebranded as optional, and fear was the justification for everything. Yet, through it all, Bush kept a consistent tone, resolve, righteousness, certainty. Even when the facts collapsed, no WMDs, no links between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, mounting casualties, his administration never admitted strategic failure. It was always framed as part of a larger mission, freedom, safety, liberation. But the costs were visible in every direction. Veterans returned with PTSD, brain injuries, and inadequate care. Military contractors like Halliburton and Blackwater made billions, and Iraq descended into sectarian violence that still hasn't fully healed. By the end of Bush's second term, the optimism of post-9/11 unity had curdled into distrust. The wars dragged on, the economy was in freefall, the government had grown, not shrunk, and the notion that America could fight a clean war had been abandoned. What remained was a nation more militarized, more secretive, and more divided than before. George W. Bush didn't just respond to 9/11, he used it to expand power, to reshape institutions, to redraw the map of acceptable policy. Some believed he kept the country safe. Others believe he permanently altered what freedom meant. Both can be true. That's what makes his presidency so complicated and so consequential. The years after 9/11 were a crucible. For George W. Bush, they marked a transformation from a president elected under the shadow of recounts and doubt into the face of American resolve. His approval rating soared to historic highs. The country, reeling from trauma, found something to hold on to in his voice. And for a time, that voice carried the weight of unity. But unity has a half-life, and governing is more than rallying. In those same years, America changed, not only in how it saw the world, but in how it saw itself. Surveillance became commonplace, rights became conditional. Dissent, once seen as a form of patriotism, got recast as threat. The Patriot Act wasn't just a law, it was a signal, a declaration that fear would now dictate policy. And while many supported the shift, comforted by the appearance of security, others watched the trade-offs stack up. Warrantless wiretaps, indefinite detentions, secret courts, and the steady erosion of transparency. Yet for all the controversy that surrounded Bush's war on terror, the domestic picture painted a different kind of legacy, one that was more complex and in some ways more telling. Take education. In 2001, Bush signed No Child Left Behind, a sweeping federal reform bill meant to bring accountability to public schools. Its goals were clear: raise standards, close achievement gaps, and ensure every child, regardless of race or zip code, got the same shot at success. The idea was noble, the rollout less so. Standardized testing became the central metric. Schools, especially in underfunded districts, narrowed their teaching to the test. Some manipulated scores, others simply fell further behind. Still, the program forced uncomfortable conversations about inequality in education. It exposed where the gaps were, and even critics of the policy couldn't ignore the urgency of its intent. Then there was Medicare Part D, Bush's 2003 expansion of prescription drug coverage for seniors. At the time, it was the largest overhaul of Medicare in decades. Critics slammed it for favoring private insurers and banning the government from negotiating drug prices. Supporters praised it as long overdue relief for aging Americans struggling with medication costs. And despite its flaws, the program proved popular with beneficiaries. Today, it's a permanent part of the healthcare landscape, a rare example of a major Bush policy that stuck without being dismantled by successors. And in immigration, Bush took a surprisingly moderate stance. In 2007, he pushed for comprehensive immigration reform, including a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. The bill failed, crushed by hardliners in his own party, but it was a telling moment. A Republican president advocating for humane, systemic immigration reform long before it became a political third rail. The country wasn't ready, but the attempt mattered. On the economy, though, the legacy is more difficult to parse. When Bush took office, the country had a surplus. By the time he left, the deficit had ballooned, driven by two wars, tax cuts, and new domestic spending. The 2001 and 2003 tax cuts were pitched as a stimulus, a way to get money back into the hands of Americans and revive growth. For many, they did. But the benefits skewed toward the wealthy, and over time, those cuts limited the government's ability to respond to economic shocks. When the 2008 financial crisis hit, the cupboard was already thin. The crash wasn't Bush's fault alone. It was decades in the making, rooted in deregulation, risky lending, and inflated housing markets. But his administration's reluctance to intervene earlier, coupled with its close ties to Wall Street, didn't help. In his final months in office, Bush approved the $700 billion bank bailout, TARP. It was controversial, it was unpopular, but most economists agree, it prevented a full-scale collapse. For a president known more for ideology than pragmatism, it was a surprisingly sober move, one that Obama would build on during his own response to the crisis. So the question becomes, what does it mean to govern in crisis? To make decisions when every option is bad? Bush's presidency offers no easy answers. What it shows is the cost of absolutism, the danger of anchoring policy to belief without leaving space for doubt. But it also shows a willingness at times to step out of party lines, to try, to compromise, even when it didn't work. That's the complicated truth of his legacy. He didn't dismantle the system, but he bent it, sometimes toward fear, sometimes toward fairness, and sometimes just toward survival. Bush's America was defined by contradictions, a war president who launched education reform, a conservative who expanded Medicare, a unifier who presided over deepening polarization. The impact of his choices didn't end when he left office. They built the scaffolding for the world that followed, a world where surveillance is normalized, where endless war is policy, where debt is routine, and where crisis, whether economic, political, or public health, is managed, not prevented. He didn't break the country, but he changed the way it braces for impact. And maybe that's the most honest way to understand his presidency, not as a chapter of triumph or tragedy, but as a pivot point, a moment when the country chose speed over caution, security over transparency, and certainty over nuance. In that moment, Bush wasn't the architect of decline. He was the accelerator. It's one thing to change the rules. It's another to live under them. And by the late 2000s, Americans were feeling the weight, not just of war or recession, but of something subtler, a growing detachment from the systems meant to protect them. In airports, shoes came off, belts came off, liquids were confiscated. TSA didn't exist before 9/11. Now it was everywhere. Security became theater, visible, routine, unavoidable. It was meant to reassure, but it also reminded. Every flight was a checkpoint, every line a symbol that this country had changed, and maybe not for the better. And that wasn't just symbolic. The Department of Homeland Security, created in 2002, ballooned into one of the largest federal agencies in existence, with over 240,000 employees across Customs, Border Patrol, FEMA, TSA, ICE, and more. It was bureaucracy fused with national anxiety. Some of its work was necessary. Some became blunt force. Immigration raids intensified, surveillance tools expanded, and the power to detain without charge or oversight found its way into domestic spaces. The line between foreign threat and internal policing blurred fast, and once that line was crossed, it rarely got redrawn. Meanwhile, on the ground, soldiers were cycling through tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, often 2, 3, 4 deployments deep. Many came back wounded, some didn't come back at all, and those who did return often met a system that wasn't ready. VA hospitals were overwhelmed, PTSD treatment lagged, employment support was scattered. America honored their service with parades and rhetoric, but the policy follow-through wasn't always there. At home, the economy was quietly unraveling. Subprime mortgages were cracking under pressure. Foreclosures were stacking up. People were losing homes they never should have been approved for in the first place. Lenders got rich off loans that were always destined to fail. And when it all collapsed, it was the public who got burned. Retirement accounts evaporated. Job losses soared. People who had done everything right, worked hard, paid taxes, bought homes, woke up to find they'd been holding the bag for a system that had already cashed out. And yet, for many Americans, especially white middle-class families, these were still the years they associate with normalcy. Gas prices were high, sure, but crime was low. Their neighborhoods felt safe. The wars were far away. The country still felt like America. That sentiment, the idea that this was a period of safety and tradition, is part of why Bush's approval ratings held up for so long, even as the cracks underneath were widening. But for black and brown communities, for poor people, for immigrants, for activists, this was not a stable time. It was a time of surveillance, suspicion, and silence. Muslim Americans were targeted under counterterrorism programs. Latino communities saw increased ICE activity. Black neighborhoods, already overpoliced, now felt the brunt of Homeland Security's domestic extensions. Even the left-leaning movements of the early 2000s, anti-war protests, labor strikes, immigrant rights marches, were surveilled under the guise of national security. In that environment, trust was eroding. Not just trust in politicians, but in systems, in media, in markets, in each other. And while the culture wars of the 1990s had been loud and performative, the early 2000s were quieter, shaped less by open debate and more by passive compliance. The phrase "support the troops" became untouchable, even as questions about the war's legitimacy grew louder. Criticism was conflated with disloyalty. And that mindset, where scrutiny equals sabotage, took root in more than just politics. It became cultural. Schools began adopting zero tolerance policies. Police began partnering with immigration enforcement. Cities invested in surveillance cameras, data fusion centers, and predictive policing. Tech companies, in their infancy, began collecting more data than most users understood. It was all happening at once, slowly, quietly, permanently. And in the background, the debt kept rising. Bush inherited a budget surplus. He left office with a $1.4 trillion deficit and a national debt that had doubled. That number didn't just matter to economists, it mattered to the future. Because once the country got used to governing in the red, it never stopped. Every tax cut, every defense budget, every emergency relief fund, it all built on that new baseline. The assumption that deficits were normal, that debt was an acceptable trade-off for short-term fixes. That's the through line. The real-world impact wasn't just in headlines or policy papers, it was in expectations, what Americans started to accept as permanent. Endless war, permanent debt, surveillance, precarity, all became normalized during Bush's presidency, and not just accepted, but embedded. What made the Bush era so consequential wasn't that it broke things. It was that it locked new realities into place, realities that wouldn't be rolled back even by the presidents who followed. History doesn't hand out erasers, it hands out patterns. And by the time George W. Bush left office in January 2009, those patterns were no longer forming. They were cemented. The wars were still ongoing. The deficit was still climbing. The surveillance state was still expanding. And the public's trust in government, in media, in institutions, had already fractured in ways that would take a generation to fully understand. Bush wasn't cartoonishly evil. He wasn't a dictator. He didn't dismantle democracy overnight. What he did was more subtle. He shifted the country's moral center through policy, language, and normalization. The things we once questioned became routine. The things we once resisted became bipartisan. He said he was a compassionate conservative. And in some ways, that's exactly what made his presidency more dangerous. Because he delivered hard policy with soft language, war with moral framing, debt with patriotic justification, oversight rollbacks wrapped in national security rhetoric. He made the country feel like it was healing, when in fact it was just numbing. It's easy to remember the Bush years as a blur of cowboy diplomacy, mission accomplished banners, and awkward press conferences. But underneath the jokes and memes is a legacy that reshaped the very architecture of American governance. The post-9/11 world he built didn't disappear when he left office. It deepened. It scaled. It became the baseline for what came next. Obama inherited that system, and rather than dismantle it, he managed it. That's not a knock, it's a truth, because once institutions grow around fear, around war, around suspicion, they don't shrink. They adapt, and they wait. Bush's legacy isn't just Iraq or Afghanistan. It's the permission he gave to future presidents to act first and explain later. It's the financial model of running deficits to maintain the illusion of prosperity. It's the surveillance state made palatable to the public. And maybe more than anything, it's the erosion of accountability dressed in the language of safety. And that erosion didn't end in 2009. It just evolved.